This is the Morgan Report with David Morgan. For the latest in precious metals investing, gold, silver, the economy, and more, go to themorganreport.com.
As a responsible person with growing concerns for your privacy and personal liberty, you want to know where we're headed and what you can do about it. We ask the experts what you need to do to take prudent and responsible action to safeguard your family's wealth and well-being, and what basic first steps will help you to be aware and prepared. ReluctantPreppers.com.
Welcome back, Reluctant Preppers. We are always delighted to have this particular returning guest tonight. He is known as the Silver Guru. His name is David Morgan. He is the founder and host of TheMorganReport.com, a subscription newsletter that gives insiders' view into the precious metals markets and including the mining sector. He is a frequently sought-after guest at conferences on precious metals. He has weighed in with us before on Bitcoin, precious metals, the world markets. He's here with us again tonight. David, thank you for joining us again here on Reluctant Preppers.
Well, thank you for having me.
We were talking about some interesting aspects of the relative scarcity of silver, and if we could kind of plunge into those tonight. First of all, the question that we were discussing is, with the world wanting to go green, wanting to use alternative energy sources, we know that there's a huge looming cliff, really, on some of the more conventional sources of electric power generation, for one. It's been said that in the next 10 to 20 years, the majority of all the coal-fired power plants in the United States will need to be completely revamped because of aging infrastructure. We've got no new nuclear plants have been permitted in decades. We've got a major push towards an increasing, the fastest growing contributor to the world's electric demand is from solar power. Typical solar powers, which are both, we have polycrystalline and monocrystalline, and they're typically connected together with lots of these little cells with interconnects that are heavily reliant on silver. But you did some research to help answer the question that we're going to pop, and that is there enough silver in the world to power the world with solar?
No, there isn't. It's a question that I have had on my mind for some time. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, but probably a couple of years at least, and something I really never got around to. I actually gave the assignment to a couple of people. There was a guy that traveled all the way over here and actually knocked on my front door and said he wanted to work for me. And I said, fine, here's an assignment. And he never really followed through on it. And I gave it to one of the guys that's, you know, been working with me for quite some time. And he does produce a lot of material and just never started. I reminded him a couple times. So it's just an arithmetic problem. And I sat down and started in on it. And as I was going through the metrics in the basic beginning research, I found there's already an article that had been accomplished about that exact question. Is there enough silver in the world to produce solar power for everyone? And it's on Seeking Alpha, and it's written by, I think it's his pen name, but it doesn't matter, Zolan Ban, and it's well done, and his numbers, I was roughing them out, but after I saw his article and read it a couple times, I said, well, that's close enough. So the first thing, and he did a great job, I think, on how he thought about this. He says, many have said how much land mass it would take to cover the amount of solar that we need. And then basically you come down to the land mass the size of Spain. So we know how much land mass you would need, but no one asked the question other than, I'm sure several people have, but here's an article that proves it. Well, how much silver would you need? And so basically he goes through the arithmetic, and when he does the whole thing, you get to 5.62 million tons of silver, which in round numbers is about 200 billion ounces of silver. I know most people think in ounces. I know I do myself. So all of the silver that's ever been brought up above the ground from time immemorial is about 50 billion ounces. So that's four times as much silver it would require to power the planet electrically than exists for all time, time immemorial. So he went in this article and he did something I thought was a good idea, which is he made some thought experiment and said, well, what if the solar panels were four times more efficient than they are now? And if that were the case, then you drop that number by a factor of four, which would be 50 billion ounces of silver, which again is all the silver ever mined for time immemorial. Is what it would take. This doesn't take into account growth or, you know, growth of demand as the world becomes more electrified and more people are hooking up to the internet and everything else. So it's a very, very simple arithmetic problem. And the answer is there is not enough silver on the planet to go solar for everybody. Can't happen. On top of that, solar really isn't very efficient. It's becoming more and more efficient all the time, but it really isn't that efficient. And the last thing that I pointed out in my podcast that I do every week now, I do a weekly perspective, I try to keep them about 10 minutes, is that solar panels are not an indefinite structure. These things wear out after a certain amount of time, depends on some variables, but you know, they're good 10, 15 years, maybe 20 if you're lucky. And then you basically need to recycle them or throw them into landfills or whatever. So again, it's something that's a nice idea. Let's go to renewables. Let's, you know, everybody be happy, but it's impractical. And that doesn't even account for what Steve Sant'Angelo and a few others have pointed out. And that is, how much oil does it take to produce a solar panel? I mean, it's not like a solar panel is something that's a freebie. It takes, you know, energy to produce one. So bottom line, I intuitively thought there was no way you could power the world with solar panels for the electrical demands that are currently needed. But it was more of a detriment than I actually thought intuitively. In other words, there's just no way that it can happen. And even if you went to a factor of 10 times more efficient, it's not going to happen. If you went to 100, you wouldn't be able to do it. So this is something that now we know. And, you know, there's other renewable type of energy situations that are, I think, far superior that should be looked at much more than solar is.
In addition to that data about monocrystalline solar and how they heavily use and rely on solar for their interconnects of their small cells, we should follow up another time talking about the thin film technology of solar. I know there's an American manufacturer by the name of First Solar that has a much lower silver content because their panels are made with a thin film coating on ordinary glass and don't need to rely on all those many, many interconnects between the small silicon cells that make up an ordinary solar cell like the ones that come from China and Canadian and so on. So we should circle back and check in on that as well. But it is interesting when you talk about a couple aspects, because even for technologies that have a relatively modest use of silver, when you scale up the world's demand for those, because, you know, people have... The same environmentalists that criticize the U.S., for example, for being a high per capita consumers and polluters, point out that if the rest of the world population, meaning everyone in Asia, everyone in Africa who currently doesn't enjoy those same amenities, the qualities of life that the people in like Western Europe and the U.S. have, they by far outnumber the people in the Western Europe and U.S., and if they start to want all of those electronic conveniences and everything, the demand for all of those products, even though they may use only a modest amount of silver, is going to go up you know, by many multiples. The other thing that you alluded to but didn't really dig into, and I thought you were going to, was you keep referring to how much silver has been mined in the history of the world, but can you talk to us about where has all that silver gone? Where is it?
Yeah, well, I can address that. There was a study done by Charles Rivers Associates way back in the early 90s. In fact, it might have been 1990. That was commissioned by the Silver Institute. And they basically asked the question of, you know, where is all that silver? And what they determined at that time, now I know I'm referring to a study that's, you know, almost two decades old. But nonetheless, the principles still hold to this day. So what they determined was, and this is an exhaustive study, that about roughly half of all the silver that had ever been mined by in that time, by 1990, was gone. meaning that it was either at the bottom of the ocean in a Spanish galleon, which is a very rare event. There's not much of that, although there's probably some. Almost all of it was in landfills. In other words, it was in applications that were not recycled, and that those applications were buried in the ground and basically never to be retrieved again. So half of it was what they called lost. And the other half was in situations that were dispersed. In other words, they were in industrial applications, electronics. They were in jewelry, silverware, and, of course, monetary instruments such as bars and coins. And so that study showed what they thought would be the amount of silver that would come back on the market, given the price dynamics. And it was a very interesting study. So most of it is... half of it's lost, and I'd say that's probably still a good number. So of the 50 billion ounces that have been mined, maybe 25 billion or so is lost, which leaves 25 billion. And there's some degree of silverware, silver jewelry, and that type of thing. But as far as monetary instruments, what exists, believe it or not, is only about 2 billion ounces. You've got roughly a billion ounces of coin, be it government minted coins such as Canadian maples or Euro Philharmonics or U.S. Silver Eagles or silver rounds, something like that, of any variety, private mintage. So that's about a billion ounces. And then you've got roughly a billion ounces in what sets the COMEX price, which is 1,000-ounce commercial bars. So if you combine those two, a billion ounces of coin and a billion ounces of bars, you get roughly 2 billion ounces. And that's the investable amount of silver. Now, you could, if you got a big demand, like I said, this Charles Rivers Associates study, where silver went, you know, very high price-wise, let's just pick a number, like $100 an ounce, for example, then some silverware would find its way to, you know, the smelter, and some jewelry would probably find its way to the smelter. But they pointed out in the study that the 1980 meltdown was very significant. And according to the study, there isn't a lot of that left. Now, again, I realize I'm talking about something that was written in 1990, and we're talking about 2017, so we're looking at, you know, 27 years. So, yes, there's more above-ground jewelry and silverware than it was in 1990. That I'm certain of. But how much is it, you know, available? And that's a market determination. The point being is that how much investment-grade silver exists, if there's about 25 billion ounces above ground, only about 10% of that is available for investment demand. That's assuming that it's all readily available to be sold, and of course it's not. It's like a stock or any other commodity. That's the availability. At what price? And the answer is, we don't know, the market knows, but the amount of silver that actually changes hands in the physical form is very, very small relative to that 2.2 or 2 billion ounces. I mean, that's a lot of that is not willing to be let go at $20 silver or $30 silver or $40 silver or even $50 silver. Some people holding those physical silver positions are not willing to let go of their silver for, you know, for a given price. And of course, the market will determine that. The point I'm trying to make is that just because there is 2 billion ounces of investment grade silver, there's a very, very small subset of that that's actually available at, you know, $17 silver. Very small, in fact.
And then that leads to the next question that's been on my mind for some time. I remember seeing a presentation by Mike Maloney, I believe it was several years back, and he was talking about how scarce truly available physical silver will be once it's no longer just the, you know, fraction of 1% of the population that is highly interested in accumulating that, but when it becomes a popular notion as it was back in 1980, for as example. I remember coming home from high school every day in 1980, pulling out finding the local newspaper on the front step, opening it up, and the big full page ad in the middle was how many times face value they would be willing to pay you to send in your silver coins. And at that point, what referring to what people now call junk silver. So 1964 and older, dimes, quarters, half dollars. And I remember starting out like 10 times and 12 times and 16, 18, 20 times. That's when it became like, when it's full page news every day in the paper, now you've got mind share of the general population. You got people's attention and people start to think, wait a minute, I'm being left out of something. When that kind of a scenario plays out, is there enough investable silver for everybody in the world to invest in? What changes that dynamic when you start talking about a fraction of what's above ground in investable form being available?
Right. Well, this is another one of these little research projects that I bounced around in my head for quite some time before I finally did it. And I did this one. If you go to any YouTube or Google search engine, any good search engine or YouTube itself, and you type in, I think it's silver market myth or silver market myths, it should pop up this video of mine, name that. And what I did in that video was I made some presumptions and also fact. And I said, what if, first of all, the U.S. population is about 5% of the total world population. So 5% of the world lives in the United States. And yet the U.S. uses about 25% of the world's resources. That's why, coming back to our first discussion about solar panels, is that everybody wanted to live like the people in the U.S. do, you need, you know, four Mother Earths, you know. So anyway, coming back on point. So I asked the question, you know, and this is one that has infuriated me for a long time about some of these coin dealers that are not, you know, as much of a silver bull as I am, but they say, well, everybody should own a little, meaning that, you know, regardless of your orientation, if you're honest money oriented or you're not, if you're pro stocks or pro Keynesian or pro Austrian or pro whatever, pro cryptocurrency, doesn't matter. The catch-all phrase is everyone should own a little. So I said, well, how much is everyone and how much is a little? So I said, well, let's just take a little being 2 ounces of silver. And let's just take the case of the United States. So if you looked at the population of the U.S., roughly going to round it to 350 million, you take 2 ounces of silver, which at the time I think was at $30 an ounce. Now we're at 17. So I said, you know, if you're going to use, let's say 17, 2 ounces, $34. $34 is not going to change anybody's life significantly. There's just no way. So if silver went up to 100, you would have, you know, 2 ounces of, you know, you'd have $200 in fiat for a $100 silver price tag. That's still not going to change your life significantly. So I said a little bit would be 2 ounces times 350 million people in the United States, which equals 700 million ounces. Which is not quite the total amount mined every year out of the entire planet. So in other words, if 5% of the world bought just 2 ounces of silver, you'd basically take out the entire mine supply, which would leave 95% of the planet unable to buy any silver because the U.S. in the Stott experiment bought it all. Now, there's a little bit of a hiccup here and there, meaning that about 150 million ounces is recycled, so you could add that to the pile. But I think my point's well taken, that, you know, 5% of the world's population bought 2.5-3 ounces of silver, 95% of the world's population could. I think there's another way to say it, and I encourage everybody to go to YouTube and watch Silver Market Myth, and I'll ask a favor of those that listen to this interview to please pass it on to those that you care to. We're always looking for new people to sign up for our free report, get on our mailing list. And we do provide great information on our mailing list. And we also do some advertising. I mean, believe it or not, I do have to pay bills, like a lot, you know, server fees, people that work for me. I mean, anyway, I digress to come back. So if you look at how much on the financial markets does silver represent? And if you look at the gold market, you eliminate real estate. So if you look at the financial markets ex real estate, which means all stocks, all bonds, options markets, the futures markets, everything that basically goes through a broker, that amount of quote-unquote money, gold represents 1% of that total. And again, we're not counting real estate. If it was real estate, it'd be even less, but we're not counting real estate. If you use silver, it's 0.02%. So that shows you how much money is in the silver market relative to the financial markets at large. I mean, it's pathetic, pathetically small. So as Mike Maloney says, just think if that number went to 0.04%. It doubled. Where would that put the silver market? And the answer is far, far, far higher. Going to digress a little bit or do a tangent, I'll say. If you go to the U.S. debt clock, and you just go to usdebtclock.org, over on the far right-hand column near the bottom, it'll show you the dollar to silver ratio, and that will show you $782 per ounce silver. And if you look at the dollar to gold ratio, what you will find is $6,448. That's exactly the numbers I'm looking at as I'm doing the interview. So what that shows you is what this debt clock is trying to convey, which is the amount of paper that's been printed relative to the amount of silver that's been mined. And if you do the math, you're going to see that it's about a 9-to-1 ratio, which is how the silver comes out of the ground relative to the gold market. So again, I couldn't concur more with Mike or him with me. It doesn't matter. I'm not here to, you know, make it who said it first or any of that. What I'm trying to convey is that the silver market is extremely, extremely small. It's extremely small relative to the gold market. And once silver takes off, it's hard to hold it back if and only if we're a fair percentage of the amount of silver investing goes into the physical market, which it does. I mean, what's interesting about silver versus gold is that silver is really dispersed widely, relatively speaking, to gold. Even though gold has about 50, a little more than 50% is held by the public at large, the other half, or roughly 50%, is still held by the banking community. In fact, banks have been net buyers of gold for many, many years in a row now. They just badmouth it. But don't look at what they say, look at what they do. Whereas on the silver side, no bank has been holding silver as a monetary asset for a very long time. Even those that you could argue, well, India held silver in some of their banks. If one, they didn't really hold it as a monetary asset, although you could argue perhaps they were thinking so. But the silver that they held was not monetary silver. What do I mean by that? It was not valid to be used on any exchange. It was not 999 fine. It wouldn't be used in a financial transaction. It couldn't be sent to London to settle delivery. So the point is that silver is held by the population at large. Very few, if any, amount of silver is held by any government. Any government that does hold even a minuscule amount doesn't hold it for monetary purposes, which is a good thing when the market really takes off again, because it's very diverse. It's spread out among a lot of strong hands. And so any new buying in a very small market will send the price far, far, far higher. And of course, we may see a discrepancy like we saw in the 2008 market, where there's two markets temporarily. There's a paper market and there's a physical market. And we saw that in the 2008 financial crisis.
You mentioned in passing a few minutes ago cryptocurrencies, and if we could get your latest thinking on that. I know you've attended conferences all over the world, and you do every year. There has been intense interest and very volatile activity in the cryptocurrencies market, with especially like Bitcoin and Ethereum and some others this year, leaping upward multiples in price and sometimes dropping in half and then taking off again. All of that in the face of silver and gold relatively flat. So could you talk to us a little bit about what your understanding is from those whom you've met with and the research that you've done and that you've encountered there about the potential ally relationship between precious metals and cryptocurrencies as alternatives to debt-based fiat currencies? And I have a follow-up question with you after that, but can you talk to us a little bit about what those in the know that you've been meeting at these conferences are saying about the near-term and longer-term futures of cryptocurrencies and their relationships to precious metals?
for a very long time, excuse me, for a very long time, the gold and silver community represented an alternative to the fiat-based Keynesian model that exists on a global basis. I mean, there's very few nation states that aren't in the Rothschild, Rothschild banking system. You've got Iran and, you know, you've got Syria. And you've got maybe a few more. So basically, the world monetary powers control everyone, regardless of what their political genre is. If it's communism, fascism, democracy, remnants thereof, or whatever, they don't care. I mean, if you go to Amstel Rothschild way back when, he says, you know, as long as I control the money, I don't care who makes the laws. They don't care what your what government they're controlling, if it's communist or non-communist. They don't care, as long as they control the money. So going back and digressing a bit, but going to the late, great Michael Rupert, who said, unless we change the way money works, nothing's going to change. So think about that. But coming on point, so now the cryptos pop up, led by Bitcoin. So now you had a competitor to an alternative currency. Now, you can make the argument that Bitcoin is limited and all that. I don't really want to go there. I just want to go through kind of a top-level thinking process. So now you have another alternative. And purportedly, it is a non-centralized blockchain free market system that's anonymous. Well, this is what gold and silver are. I mean, silver and gold, basically, it's in your pocket. You can settle in coin and basically keep it a private transaction. And now you have a alternative to that, which is, of course, cryptocurrency. So a good thing became a better thing. Ethereum, I think I'm favorable to the blockchain. But then what happened was there were a lot of Johnny-come-latelys. I should say Johnny-come-latelys, but it took a while for this to accelerate. And any good market idea does get a phase of kind of the very early adopters. And then you get the next phase, which I think we've entered, where you get a lot of copycats. So a lot of these cryptos are meaningless, but there are a lot of people that are jumping on them because it's a quick buck. Now, there's also a lot of adaptation that's going on, which is monetizing or accounting for almost anything in the physical realm. In other words, this AC chain that's been talked about so much here in the last 3 weeks. They did it with tea. I mean, tea is a real good. And if you put this on some type of a coin format or a crypto coin format, you've got a real asset. It's called tea or wood. And the idea here is that you could basically monetize almost anything that has tangible wealth to it. You know, aluminum, again, cotton. You could go with foodstuffs. You could go with a lot of things. Now, if those coins represent physical goods in digital space, that's a rather powerful thing, and it's an alternative to, let's say, silver and gold. So I think that there is a lot that we will see. I don't think it's going away. Philosophically, I'm not a strong proponent of it. I do own some Ethereum and some Bitcoin because I've been paid in it. The Morgan Report is actually translated into German. It's translated into Chinese, Mandarin, and it is translated into Spanish. And so some of the payment systems that I get through the Spanish version, I'm paid in Bitcoin and Ethereum because my associates in Mexico are pretty big on the blockchain and Bitcoin and on all the cryptos, or most of them, let's say. So anyway, back on point, let's see where the market takes it. But it is a competitor, and rightfully so. I mean, people are looking for alternatives. My fear is that it's not as decentralized as most proponents claim it to be. But I don't have a lot of knowledge in that space. I'm still researching. I'm still open-minded about it. For me, there's two theories of money. There's specie money, which is intrinsic physical that has been around, which is basically gold and silver throughout history. And then you have a legal contract of some type that is also another form of money. It boils down to those two basic ideas. Money's whatever I say it is. It's this idea, and it's this legal binding situation. which is, of course, what a blockchain basically is. I mean, all these white papers are about what the contract is or how it's going to be backed or not backed. And then you've got, you know, something that's lasted for, you know, thousands of years, which, of course, are, you know, gold and silver. I still lean that direction, but I think I'm open-minded enough or try to remain so that the market is going to determine the ultimate outcome. And, of course, it's a hybrid, and I will be forthright that I am working with some people on a silver-backed cryptocurrency, and there are already some out there, and there are some gold-backed cryptocurrencies as well. I think that's one model that may be the best of both worlds, maybe not. I'm doing it very cautiously. I do have some skin in the game, so I'm talking my own book in a way. Whether this comes to fruition or not remains to be determined, because it's in the legal process now, and the way we're doing it is different than some of the others, which means it's going to be a very lengthy but very diligent legal process to determine what we are required to do and not do throughout the cyber world. And so that, again, will be forthcoming, and I am involved, but at a small level, which means, yes, I put up some capital to fund it along with many others. I'm not alone in this, but the amount I have at risk is a manageable risk for me. So if the whole thing doesn't ever come to fruition, I believe it will, but if it doesn't, I'm not out like, you know, half my life savings or anything like that.
One of the concerns that people on our channel have expressed in their comments whenever a guest discusses cryptocurrencies is not just so much that it is a transient thing, a thing that doesn't really exist and doesn't have anything physical behind it, but that if it actually becomes a credible threat to the monopolistic power of the banking system, that, as you mentioned, like with the Rothschilds and so on, that have been, depending on who you listen to, have basically run the world for centuries, that it will be crushed as all other competition to monopolies get crushed. Do you foresee, as you look at the potential hybrid formation of something that's physically backed but can be electronically transacted or something, do you think that there's a real credible concern there that the powers that be, whether it's the banks or the governments or whatever, will not tolerate, would see this as a just a direct attack against their complete power and domination that they have right now because of their control over the money supply?
Absolutely. I can remember this day being a very young man and, I'll call myself bright. Please don't hate me for that or, put in the comments section. But, I was alert and aware, and academically I was always inclined to do well. And I remember the day I heard that money is power. And when I heard that sentence, money is power, I didn't like it at all because I thought money was kind of an inert thing. I didn't know much about it. I was very young when I heard this lecture. I was in grade school. And, of course, money is power. Or if you believe what I believe, then you can believe that money is power. As I said earlier about the Rothschilds, and, I don't care. But it doesn't say I don't care what government system you have. I just care. But when he says, I don't care who makes the laws as long as I control the money. And it's true. So it is a big concern because that power base will not be surrendered easily. I mean, if any of these situations get to the point where the power structure feels threatened, they are going to use the money that they have, the power that they have, which is more than money. I mean, there's other forms of power. Believe me, I understand that. But money is also power. And, what can't be bought in America? I mean, politicians can be bought. I mean, anyway, let me not go down that rabbit hole. So that threat will definitely bring about a great deal of resistance from the current power structure. Now, I'll go one step further. That's why we are doing the work that we are doing in the legal sense that might, and I say might, be able to isolate us and truly become a legally sound, jurisdictionally inert situation that would be outside the purview of the power structure at large. And we would probably not be the only ones, which means that some of these situations might be, let's say, penetrated or brought down or compromised in some way, whereas there'll probably be some that will be very small, relatively speaking, to the power structure where they don't even bother with. I mean, if you've got somebody, you know, that's at such a low level, it's like gold and silver is now, basically. I mean, the mainstream ignores it. The only time they really mention gold and silver is usually if it's going down in price, not up. When it does go up, they do have to mention it, but they kind of poo-poo it. And it'd be the same way here. There might be a few cryptos that are gold and silver backed or not. That might be asset backed in some way that they really don't want to bother with. I mean, it's again like the silver market. It represents 0.02% of the entire system financially. Yet there's so much leverage in that because, again, it's such a small market. You don't need much more interest in it. And since it is a physical monetary asset that most people have forgotten about, it doesn't take a lot of new interest to really rock the boat. But again, I digress. So yes, it's important. I think that a lot remains to be determined because as the system unravels further and further, and I know people are kind of tired of hearing about this because I know SGT Report brings it up almost every show. And, you know, it's the cover of The Economist magazine with the gold coin around the Phoenix's neck and all the currencies burning at its feet. Some have argued it's a gold coin, and now many are arguing that's a crypto coin of some type. Regardless of what it is, the current system is on its final throes. There's no doubt about that. What the alternative will be, whether it's all mapped out ahead of us or not, I would say how many times do the bankers lose? And the answer is they don't lose very many times. So is there alternatives? Yes. Are all these alternatives everything that they are sold as? And the answer is no. So again, buyer beware. Just because some of the better personalities on the internet tell you certain things, make sure that you research it for yourself. I think, as I do in almost all of life's issues, I think I want to strike a balance. I would want a balance between my crypto position and real money. I would want, you know, balance in most areas of my life. So if you want to speculate on some of these unbacked crypto, you know, situations, be my guest, but be very careful. Other areas, again, there will probably be some viable situations, some that we haven't even seen or thought of yet, that may come to the fore. Regardless of what your philosophical bent may be, these may, you know, start to really make inroads into the system. But to repeat, if it makes too big an inroads, you might see some resistance to it via the current power structure.
Could you give us, before we wrap, you mentioned something, that, a show that people should watch about the silver myth or something like that. What's the link they should go to for that one?
Yeah, just go to YouTube and type in The Great Silver Market Myth. So it's got 167,000 views on it. It's fun. It's only 3.5 minutes. You'll get a kick out of it. And again, if you go to my website, get on the Morgan Report free email list. You'll get stuff like that and a lot of other stuff for free. And of course, we have a paid service and we cover all the resources except energy. We were the first on rare earth elements. We've looked at the what we call the energy metals. We've done, you know, did cobalt, lithium, vanadium, several others. We looked at the competitors of silver, which is, you know, aluminum. Going back to the beginning of the interview, you talked about, you know, thin sheet and the other type of solar. And there's this NatCore. I met with the CEO of NatCore at the New Orleans Gold Show a couple of years ago. And me and Chris Marchese sat down with them for a long time. And they claim they have a solar system, solar panel that is 100% silver free. It uses aluminum. I'm open-minded. I didn't see enough data to convince me that it's as good as silver. I'm not saying aluminum doesn't reflect. It does. That's like in the early CD world. You had really high-end ones that were silver, and then you most of them turned to aluminum because it reflects enough for that laser to hit it and play. So why wouldn't you? It's cheaper. If it functions, you know, it functions 100% of the time. There's no reason you shouldn't substitute silver. Silver's more expensive than aluminum. I do. But anyway, whether or not that works in solar panels, I'd say it's to be determined. I'm only throwing that out there, Dunnigan, because, you know, I want people to know that I'm pretty deep in these topics. I'm not a surface type of guy. Certainly doesn't mean I get everything. I do miss things from time to time. But that's one I'm pretty much on top on is the solar situation.
Very good. David, we just appreciate your presence here always with us on Reluctant Preppers, and we'd love to have you back again. People can find your work at themorganreport.com. Any final words before we let you go?
No, that's it. And if you're looking to get into this market for the cheap, the best thing to do is go to the book tab and buy either the Silver Manifesto or Second Chance or both. I mean, for the money paid, you're going to get a great education. And it's kind of a do-it-yourself manual if you buy both books. One is how to analyze a mining company, whether it's silver, gold, lithium, cobalt, or whatever. It shows you the outline of the thinking process that we do at the Morgan Report. And then Second Chance shows you why 90% of the move lies ahead of us. So if you're new to the sector or you've been painfully waiting for the last 6 years, I don't think you have much longer to wait. And the big move lies ahead, so it's the wrong time to get out of this market. You might not need to buy any more. You might just be happy holding what you have. But the big move, I think, is going to start in 2018 and probably last for a couple of years. So certainly we'll turn those frowns into smiles here, I think, in the not too distant future.
Well, David Morgan, founder of themorganreport.com, thank you once again, as always, for joining us here on Reluctant Preppers.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is The Morgan Report with David Morgan. For the latest in precious metals investing, gold, silver, the economy, and more, go to themorganreport.com.